From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President Bush's former top aide, Karl Rove, gets a subpoena from the House Judiciary Committee. But will he actually talk? Barack Obama volunteers face racial incidents on the campaign trail, and a new leader of the NAACP steps up to the plate. For these topics and more, we've got Kevin Merida. He's an associate editor at The Washington Post and co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Also with us, CNN analyst and radio host Roland Martin. He's also a special correspondent for Essence magazine. Great to have you guys on.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Farai.
So the House Judiciary Committee has served former Bush aide Karl Rove with a subpoena. He's scheduled to appear on July 10th to testify on his alleged role as a key player in the dismissals of nine U.S. attorneys. Kevin, Karl Rove has been served before, so tell us more about what this is about and whether you think he's even going to say anything.
Well, the Bush administration has been, tried to block all efforts to have their top aides testify, citing that, private conversations, fall under the realm of executive privilege. And so, usually they're pretty successful. Administrations are pretty successful at that. I think that Karl Rove, for the Democrats, he's been, kind of the puppet master in their minds, the key figure behind a lot of the mischief in the Bush administration and things that they're trying to get at. John Conyers is known as a very aggressive House Judiciary Committee chairman on such things, and I know he will continue to force this issue, even if they don't get him to actually testify and say anything. The idea that the former top aide has been subpoenaed, and it I think they believe it helps them politically.
And this latest discussion is around whether or not Karl Rove spoke of essentially neutralizing an opponent, a political opponent, by dealing with charges against that person. Roland, how do you see this playing out in terms of the questions many citizens have about whether or not government is corrupt or whether there's unjust retribution for not being on one person's side or the other?
Well, this is a last gasp attempt by the Democrats to, frankly, get Karl Rove for a final time before President Bush leaves the White House in January 2009. And so we have had this swirling around. You have the allegations that Karl Rove was a mastermind behind the indictments against the former governor in Alabama. Of course, he's been let out of prison. The judge has even said there are some issues there with this prosecution. That's what this is about. We know that politically that the president has a prerogative to replace U.S. attorneys. But the real issue here is to what extent did politics play a role? And the problem is the administration initially said, oh, no, everything was above board. And then, of course, we found information that wasn't the case. That's what this is about. This is an effort to get Karl Rove. And so their deal is if they can get to him anyhow, we all forget Al Capone may have been a murderer, but they got him based upon tax evasion.
Kevin, when you look at this, has this ship pretty much sailed? The Bush administration is, if not marching out the door, at least sort of edging towards the door. This is what's called a lame duck phase of the presidency. Is it pretty much over at this point?
Well, yeah, it is pretty much over. A lot of the top aides that were in the White House, most of them have all gone, including Karl Rove. Karl Rove's out writing columns for Newsweek now. But I think that in the context of politics in this political year, I think the Democrats want to continue to remind the public of some of the abuses of the Bush administration. And this is part of this. Roland mentioned, this led to the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez, his attorney general, because Democrats put so much heat on the administration that finally they had to let Alberto Gonzalez go. And so the idea of influencing the judiciary is something that really most Americans would be upset about. And if they can tie that, the more they can remind people of these kind of allegations, I think they believe it helps them politically.
Let me stay with you, Kevin, talk about an article that you actually wrote. It was a very compelling article about racial incidents that some Obama volunteers experienced. Give us just one example.
One example was a woman who was a phone banker in northeastern Pennsylvania, did about 60 phone calls, and she told me that most of the calls were really depressing. A lot of racial invective on the calls. One caller, as she remembers, said, I'm not going to vote for Obama. Hang that darkie from a tree. There was a break-in at the Vincennes, Indiana campaign office of Obama, where a plate glass window was pushed in, American flag stolen, and a number of hate messages. Now, you know, people can argue whether it's racist or not, or these are racially based, but certainly bigotry, as they mentioned that, you know, Hamas supports Obama, and they used made references to Jeremiah Wright. There have been a number of volunteers who said that they were called, the N-word. White volunteers were called N-word lovers. So there was a pretty long dossier of this. Which is not to say that this is the prevalent experience or the dominant experience of Obama volunteers, but it is something that I think has been kind of under the radar and not been brought to light very much.
Roland,
this is a very important story, and mm-hmm. I think when I've heard conservative commentators and talk show hosts sort of dismiss this as, well, look, there are people like this, but it's not the majority of people. That is absolutely correct. But I think we got to keep in mind that is, this could be very well a tight election. We saw it in 2000, we saw it in 2004, and when you look at voters in Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, when you had 10, 12, 15, 16, 20% of the voters in a Democratic primary say that race was the number one factor in how they decided to vote, that could make a difference. When you have a state where 2, 3, 4, 5 million people vote, okay, in a Democratic primary, let's just say it's 4 million people. And let's say just 10% of the people say the race of the candidate was the number one factor. That is 200,000 votes. And so there were a number of states that Bush won, I think it was like 10 states, by less than 200,000 votes. And so I think people should not dismiss this as, well, you know, that's fine. No, if people sit here and say that we should have one America and we should not be calling ourselves African-American, Irish-American, whatever the case may be, then we should be examining the racial attitudes that persist, because that is a significant problem, even at 10 or 20%.
Quickly, both of you, Kevin first, do you think the Obama campaign would rather keep these things on the hush because it undermines this idea that a black man is electable?
Well, I think there's no question about that. I got several calls in advance of the story's publication with concerns about it and wanted to make sure it was put in proper context, et cetera. I think that, you know, Obama campaign has gone through the past several months where there's been a very much the race of the candidate has been brought to light, and there's been a racial focus because of the remarks of Jeremiah Wright, and they've been dealing with that. And I think that they don't want it to be become the focus of his campaign. So they did not even want the incident in Vincennes, Indiana, reported. In fact, they told the volunteer there to just clean up the hate messages and not to make a big thing of it.
Roland, just quickly on this, because I want to get your feedback on the NAACP as well.
Sure. Bottom line on this particular topic, the Obama campaign, sure, they don't want the focus to be on this. In fact, Obama has said repeatedly that if he is not elected, it won't be because of his race, it will be because the American people did not buy into his policies and positions. They want the focus to be on his particular points and not his race, but the bottom line is going to be there. Hillary Clinton had to deal with the issue of sexism on the campaign trail. We have to accept the reality that race is there, and people should be fighting against it versus by saying it's really no big deal.
I want to move on. We just have a couple minutes left for the NAACP question. 35-year-old Benjamin Jealous was elected last Saturday by a vote of 34 to 21. Now, Roland, the NAACP was without a leader for over a year. Do you think that this was a controversial? It was a split vote, but is it a controversial selection?
Well, it was controversial in the sense that, according to my sources on the board, Reverend Frederick Haynes out of Dallas, Friendship West Baptist Church, was the first choice of the search committee. That Jealous was the only finalist who went before the board. The board met for 8 hours, did not vote on this until almost 3 o'clock in the morning. People wanted all three finalists. Alvin Brown, former Clinton official, was also one of the finalists. But my sources say that Julian Bond, the board chairman, really pushed for Jealous to only be the only one. And so you had some issues there. I mean, obviously, a 34-21 vote, I mean, look, you will want a unanimous selection or even a much broader one than that. It does say that some people are unsettled with Jealous because he served in various capacities, different places for 3 years at a time. Bottom line is they need consistency. They need leadership.
All right.
That's the issue.
All right, Kevin, really quickly. Can the NAACP...
Well, I had lunch.
Please.
I was going to say I had lunch with Ben Jealous, ironically, right before Super Tuesday, and he was very much involved in voter mobilization with a group called Power PAC that's based in mobilizing black voters based in San Francisco, and they mobilize voters across the South and support Obama. So he comes from an activist political background, and that I think some people see as a refreshing change.
All right. Well, Kevin and Roland, always great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Kevin Merida is an associate editor of The Washington Post and co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. He joined me from the studios at The Washington Post. And Roland Martin is a CNN analyst and host of The Roland S. Martin Show on WVON-AM in Chicago. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. If a child commits a crime, even a serious one, should they go through the same justice system and pay the same price as an adult? That's just one of a host of issues surrounding juvenile justice. Today, as part of our ongoing series on criminal justice, we look at how kids end up behind bars and what other options judges have when faced with a young offender. For more, we have Carol Schofer, Executive Director of the Youth Law Center. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you. Welcome.
So let's start with a little scenario. There's a 16-year-old and his friend who go into a convenience store. They ask for money. The clerk says no. The friend shoots the clerk. If the 16-year-old is arrested and charged, what are some of the possible paths that the justice system could take with the person who was not the shooter but who was part of this crime?
Well, in virtually every state, the accomplice will be equally guilty as the shooter and will be charged the same as the shooter because of this is a basic criminal justice issue, not a juvenile justice issue, and it's a felony murder rule. So that's the first point. In different states, the young person will be handled in different ways. In some states, they will automatically be tried as an adult because of the nature and severity of the crime. In some states, it will be the option of the district attorney as to whether to charge them as an adult. And in some states, the court will have the option as to whether to charge them as an adult or as a juvenile.
What's the difference between juvenile court and adult court? What makes juvenile court different in terms of both how it proceeds and the impact on someone's life?
Well, there are lots of differences. The first difference and the major difference is in many juvenile courts, there's no right to a jury trial. There are other procedural rights that you may not have, like the right to a preliminary hearing. The intent of the juvenile court is to provide rehabilitative services or habilitative services to juveniles, and the jurisdiction and length of the sentence is somewhat shorter. So we feel juvenile court is a more appropriate place for a young offender. They are losing some procedural rights, but they are gaining the right to some kind of service and treatment and to a limitation on the length of time that they can serve.
So, and once someone has committed a juvenile crime and served their time, sometimes the records are sealed. Isn't that correct?
Yes, the records can be sealed. They exist. They are confidential. In some places, see, again, it's difficult to generalize across the country. In some places, you have access to those records. In some places, you don't. But in every place, you can get those records sealed after a certain period of time.
What do we know about the ways that young offenders are tracked into different types of programs, juvenile detention centers versus boot camps versus other alternatives. You know, what kind of options are there once someone has been sentenced as a juvenile in terms of where they go?
Once you're sentenced as a juvenile, there's a broad array of options. Detention centers are primarily for pretrial. They're the equivalent of what we think of as a jail in the adult system. Boot camps, the equivalent of juvenile prisons, which are often called training schools, are the most serious option for juveniles, short of being tried and sentenced to the adult system. But theoretically, and in many jurisdictions, there are many less severe options, which are treatment-based options, which could be at-home confinement with intensive services. It could be confinement to a group home or any other kind of habilitative program. Juveniles should have a right to services because they've given up their right to things like a jury trial in return for services. Unfortunately, with the attitude in the country that is a get tough on crime and fear of youth attitude, more and more juveniles go into the more severe settings. And of course, and I think this is very relevant to your show, there is a huge racial disparity in where children end up.
Give me a sense of that.
Well, there is a disparity in every single state, and the data changes state by state, but in every single state there is a huge disproportionality between the number of particularly African-American but also Latino youth who wind up in high-level facilities as opposed to Caucasian youth who wind up in high-level facilities. So, I mean, it can,
and by high-level, you mean the higher security?
More intensive, more secure facilities. Ironically, or maybe not so ironically, when you look at facilities that have a high level of treatment, you'll see disproportionately white youth in the high level of treatment facilities. But from the very first day, when we start with arrest, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, but moving on through the system, there is continuous and increased disproportionality. That doesn't even deal with the real disproportionality in the system between families that have assets and families that have fewer assets. So youth in the juvenile justice system are primarily African American and Latino, but are almost entirely low-income youth.
I know someone who basically committed a crime as a young man and got a felony conviction, and then found out that most people who had money to hire a lawyer would have gotten a misdemeanor, and it changed his entire life. Is that something that happens to people who don't have means?
This is a huge issue, because the quality of representation for juveniles, even more so than for adults, is very disparate. So in addition to the fact that possibly the system has some biases in it against youth who are either African-American, Latino, poor, there is also the question of what kind of representation can you obtain. And public defenders for juveniles are the newest public defenders, or public defenders who have often decided that they don't want to advance. So you can have wonderful juvenile public defenders, and I don't want to criticize everyone, but in many cases, your less experienced, less competent attorney is in the juvenile system. In many instances, if there are co-defendants, as in the case you described at the very beginning of this discussion, the adult will get the more experienced attorney who can make a better deal for them, ironically, and the juvenile will get the less experienced attorney who is being paid less even, and who is anxious to make that deal. And I imagine in your friend's case, they may have just made a deal to say, you want to just get out of this, and it's just a juvenile offense, and it's no big deal. That isn't true anymore. A couple of questions ago, you asked me about records being sealed. That is true to some extent, but more and more, the fact that you have a juvenile felony still precludes you from lots of kinds of employment and other things. So in California, for example, you cannot be a peace officer if you are convicted of a juvenile felony, despite the fact you didn't have a jury trial, you may have pled out thinking this is no big deal, but it is a big deal. It stays on your record for some purposes forever. And then when we come to issues like immigration status, it's a huge problem.
Carol, thanks for the information.
Oh, thank you very much.
Carol Schofer is the executive director of the Youth Law Center. And we just spoke about how kids end up in jail or detention, but what is it really like inside? Mario Chavez spent his teenage years in and out of detention centers. Then, at the age of 17, he was convicted as an adult for second-degree murder. He spent 8.5 years in prison, and today he works as a youth mentor with Pioneers for Peace, an organization working to curb youth violence. Mario, thanks for coming on.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. So, you know, tell me how you first ended up, how and when you first ended up in a detention center.
The first time I'd have to say it was about when I was 15 years old. And it was a detention center. It wasn't a boot camp, per se. It was awaiting trial. And sometimes they, you know, the juvenile system, sometimes they'll give you a bond and sometimes they won't give you a bond. So then you're left with no way out but to be in the detention center awaiting trial.
So when you talk about no bond, that means you can't get out. However, I understand that when you were in juvenile detention, you went in and out, but you were never convicted for the things you were sent there for. Why did that happen? How did that play out?
The first offense was I was joyriding, and we were in Southwest Detroit. And it's a pretty close-knit neighborhood, and it's mainly, you know, it's mainly poor people, you know, and it's basically the Latin part of the Detroit area, and We knew the people that we were in their car joyriding, so it was just a matter of getting to them and speaking to them and asking them to drop the charges, you know. So that's pretty much how it went.
Now, while you were in detention, how did you see people treat each other? And by that I mean, you know, just as there are gangs in adult prisons, sometimes there are gangs in juvenile detention centers. What was your detention center like? Was it safe? Was it dangerous? Was it full of fights? What was it like?
Well, there was a constant breakout of fights. I was in the Detroit juvenile detention center. And I don't know, it's very different from the environment that I work in right now. Being the Grand Rapids Detention Center. It's a much more calmer, much more slower pace detention center. But yes, there was that gang affiliation in the detention center.
So if a kid said, I'm not going to be affiliated, did that mean that he was more at risk than if someone was affiliated?
Well, at the time when I was in the juvenile detention center, it was like a fad or the thing to be in, you know, the thing to do. So it was more of a trend at that time. So it was basically it wasn't by force, it was by choice once you got into the juvenile detention center. But then there was, you know, fringe benefits with that choice. I mean, you know, camaraderie, a lot of just being easier, you know.
Now, you got out of detention. You mm-hmm. went out on the streets and you ended up being convicted of second-degree murder. What happened?
Well, basically, when I was in the detention center, it was two times before, and the charges got dropped, and I got out. And basically, I had this notion that, you know, if I ever got into, you know, trouble, I could get out of it, because that was my experience with the juvenile detention center and juvenile process. And I got into a shootout, and unfortunately I shot an individual and he died. And I was a juvenile at the time. I was 17 years old. But when they arrested me, they were like, whoa, you know, he's only 17. He's not 18 years old. He's a juvenile. So I end up spending the night at the juvenile detention center. And then the next day, they went to arraign me, which you're not supposed to get arraigned in juvenile detention when you're in that system. it's a whole different procedure. And I was like, what's going on? And they were like, we're gonna put you over, we're gonna charge you as an adult because of the severity of the crime. And I was like, whoa, you know. So it was definitely an eye opener.
How is it different in adult prison than juvenile detention?
Oh, it was harsh. I mean, you're in there with grown men. I was only 17, maybe 160 pounds, you know. It just was it was quite the dramatic change, you know, from the juvenile detention center. I mean, it was a whole nother world.
And then when you got out of prison, you were the victim of violence. What happened then?
Yeah, ironically, or I don't know, maybe karma, but yeah, I was got out of prison. I actually had the judge was very, I want to say, gave me a chance, you know, gave me the opportunity to, if I messed up in prison and wanted to be a hardhead, I could have stayed in there as long as they wanted to keep me. But luckily for me, the judge said I had 8 to 25, meaning that, you know, if I kept my nose clean and did everything I was supposed to, I could be out in a little over 8 years, which is was my reason. When I got out, I went to college while I was in prison, and I got a heating and cooling mechanical license. So when I came out, I really had something, you know, to go to, really had something to turn to. And even though I had that second degree murder on my file, you know, there's no way you could hide that. You know, I was upfront and truthful with my employers. And of course, a couple employers said yes, a couple of them said no, but I got hired underneath the company, and I was doing great for a year. I was getting paid like $25 an hour, staying out of trouble. I mean, I was on parole. I mean, things were great. Couldn't be better. And one morning I was loading up my truck for services that day. I had a route that I had to go through. And we had contracts with certain commercial businesses. And the company, at that time I was a supervisor. I moved up through the company. And they gave me the keys to the warehouse and everything. And I was driving an H2 Hummer. It was the company's Hummer, but it wasn't mine, but I drove it like it was mine. And I was there early in the morning, and no one was there. I was downtown Detroit, warehouse district. It was right after 4th of July, 2004. And it was July 7th. It was early in the morning. I was still a little bit groggy, you know, loading up my truck. And I heard what sounded to be like firecrackers in the background. And that's what I chalked it up to be. I was like, oh, it must be some, you know, some kids lighting off some extra firecrackers that they had from 4th of July. And I was loading up the back of the Hummer with a compressor. And as I was leaning over into the Hummer, I heard something hit the truck. And I knew it just wasn't, it sounded like a stone, but it sounded like really solid, you know. And I was like, wow. And I already knew what it was. And before I could even let go of the compressor, I was leaning over into the vehicle of the back of the Hummer. I got shot in the back. Ended up getting shot 3 times. And I became paralyzed from the waist down. So I'm wheelchair bound right now.
You know, your story, you have so much to your story that we want to continue after a break. And I know that, you know, you're working with a group called Pioneers for Peace. Before we go to that break, just give me a sentence or two on what Pioneers for Peace does.
Pioneers for Peace is a community-based organization out of Detroit that we work with the youth and disenfranchised communities, and mainly Detroit Public Schools, Job Corps. Actually, we have a peace rally May 31st at off of Spokane Street, right in the west side of Detroit, and it's going to be a concert with Mos Def and Trick Trick.
All right, I'm going to talk to you more after that, after the break. Thanks, Mario.
All right, thank you.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're talking to former juvenile offender Mario Chavez. He's now a youth mentor for Pioneers for Peace. Thanks for sticking with us. And let me just ask you, you were talking about a concert. that you guys are putting on. Tell me a little bit about the concert, but then I want to know, really, what are you doing as an organization with the kids?
Well, the Peace Rally this Saturday coming up, May 31st, actually, it's going to be held where an old school used to be, and it's just a field. And we spoke with other community leaders and people of the administrative Detroit City Hall, and we're going to have a peace rally there, a gathering, and a concert, so that the whole neighborhood could come together, because there've been quite a few shootings over there in that area.
What do you do on the day to day with the young folks you work with at Pioneers for Peace?
Well, depending on right now, it's summertime, so we're gonna go into our like a summer camp type thing that we do with them, and you know, to keep them busy during the summer and to keep them engaged in positive aspects of their life.
And how old are the kids we're talking about?
Oh, they're ranging, they're boys and girls, ranging from as young as 11 to 17 years old.
This may sound naive, but do you think it works? Do you think what you're doing makes a difference?
Actually, yeah, I'd have to say so. Most of the time, a child just needs some attention, a little bit of guidance, you know, and just needs to know that they're not alone in this world, you know, with all these things going on around them, despite the environment that they're living in, just to know that somebody's there and somebody's willing to listen and willing to, you know, say, well, wait, you know, whatever situation you may be in, you always have a choice, you know.
Mario, so, thank you.
Okay.
Mario Chavez is a youth mentor for Pioneers for Peace, and he spoke with us from the studios of WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The smartphone war is heating up. It's not official yet, but rumors have it that the latest incarnation of the iPhone will hit stores sometime this June. Not to be outdone, Sprint says it's going to release its answer to the iPhone. There are also reports that BlackBerry is going to make a phone with a touchscreen. To sort through gadgets and talk about an innovative way to get kids involved in science, we have our tech contributor, Mario Armstrong. Hey, Mario.
Hey, Farai. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. I have been resisting the iPhone bandwagon. I'm going to ride my janky little phone into the ground until the components fall out and hit the pavement.
Your little old clamshell.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, maybe once that one's dead, I'll take a look at these other options. So let's start going through them. You know, the new iPhone right now is a rumor or a reality?
Yeah. It's a rumor. What they're saying is that the new iPhone will launch somewhere around June 9th in tandem with the Worldwide Developers Conference. And so the reason why this rumor is kind of starting to surface more is because at the same time, AT&T has announced that they are completing what is called their 3G rollout. And that basically makes it for faster speeds than the current edge network that they have. So if they can roll out this 3G network in time with this rumored iPhone launch date, that means the new iPhone would have faster speeds and maybe more people would be wanting that particular device.
So what about the idea that the current iPhone, which then would be the old iPhone, is going to drop in price?
Right. You hope. You know, I mean, Apple, you know, Apple has shown over the years with their, if you look at their iPod models and how they kind of held some features back for newer versions of the iPod. And then as newer versions came out, newer features would come out. Some of the prices didn't really shift too much. I mean, they would shift a little bit, but not too much. And when you're talking about a $400 phone, any shift downward would be a nice welcome shift. But, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not people are actually going to want a device that would be used on an old data network. The main limitation to Apple's iPhone has been the AT&T, or the lack thereof, AT&T's 3G network. If that main limitation can be removed, you might see more and more people wanting to investigate or try out or experiment with the iPhone.
Let's talk about this new phone that Sprint is going to release called the Instinct, and that also the BlackBerry makers are going to release a touchscreen phone. You know,
that's right.
How much do these things cost, and, you know, what's the good or bad of them?
Yeah, I mean, these are the category that people are arguing about is whether or not these phones fall into what is called a smartphone category. And that category usually means you can do internet, instant messaging, email, all types of web applications.
Dental floss for you.
Yeah, dental floss, pocket protector for others. But the BlackBerry, these devices, I should say, is probably anywhere between $300 and $600. Some are even more expensive than that, but that's usually the range. With the one exception, there's a Centro created by Palm, which is a handheld device that I recommend quite often, really, because it's only $99, and it's a great smartphone. But to your point, BlackBerry is coming out with something that they haven't named yet. The code name so far, the rumored name, is Thunder. The one that they have released recently from BlackBerry actually looks really, really good. The BlackBerry Bold, it looks like an iPhone. And then Samsung is looking at releasing their Instinct. HTC has a touchscreen version called the Touch. And I think what at the end of the day, Farai, I think all of these phones have recognized, or all of these phone manufacturers recognize, Apple has changed the game with touchscreen technology, and they want to participate in it as well.
Oh, boy. So too many options. Now, let's move on to something that is a little different. It's a contest. American students have fallen behind students from other countries when it comes to learning about science and technology. I know that's an issue close to your heart. So yes. Discovery Communications is sponsoring a new national science competition for middle schoolers. So what is this Young Scientist Challenge?
Yeah, it's the Discovery and 3M Young Scientist Challenge, your grades 5th through 8th grade, and they are basically looking for America's top young scientists and also teachers, and they are wanting to nurture more interest for kids at an earlier age in science. So what somebody has to do essentially for this variety is to create a 1 to 2 minute video about one of Discovery Education's topics, and they get enrolled into this competition, and there's several prizes, there are savings bonds, there are educational opportunities, and a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet other scientists.
So if they have to make videos, not everybody has access to equipment. I mean, is this something where youth groups and schools can help the students put things together?
That's a great, great question, because that was one of my concerns, right? The barrier. I mean, I know they think, or the internet makes it easier, but, you know, you need to think about what your school can offer, what the library may have, or what the Boys and Girls Club in your neighborhood may have as well. You can also look at your cell phone. If you have cell phones or friends that have cell phones, you can capture video on that cell phone. They are not interested for this contest in the quality of the production more than they are in you being able to explain science concepts. They list 5 different concepts on their website that you have to read up on and then use the 1 to 2 minutes to show your science aptitude to communicate and present these concepts.
Now, you actually do some work with charter schools in the Baltimore area. And what is it that you're doing?
So some of the work is really about getting more kids and more schools really to understand the tools that they can integrate into education. It's amazing when we travel around to find that, you know, opportunities like this exist, but many of the schools and the communities that we like to serve aren't aware of these opportunities. And so one of the things that I would like to just kind of put my neck out there and say is I'm in the Maryland, D.C. area. So if there are any parents that are tuning in the Maryland, D.C. area and you think you have a young scientist on your hands but don't have the means to capture video, go to my website. Find a way to contact me through my website. You can send me an email, and I'll set up a date to come out there and shoot the video myself. I just feel it's so important, Farai, that we get our kids. You know, I don't want to hear anything about barriers to challenges to these types of opportunities that are being afforded to our kids.
Well, Mario, what I'm going to have you do is email me your promise and the link to your information, and we'll put it up on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org, and our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. So, you know, that's a great offer. Shoot, you got free technical assistance and videography right there.
Just quickly,
why is it important for students in America, including African Americans, to step up their game with math and science?
Because it's on. I mean, the war is on, Farai. You look at China, you look at India, these kids are graduating in science and technology at a phenomenal rate. They're pursuing it faster. It's in their DNA, and their innovation is starting to permeate itself over here. And they're also bringing that prowess and that education back to their countries. We are no longer going to be as competitive as we used to if our kids don't start recognizing that they can be as creative and innovative as everyone else.
All right, Mario, thanks again.
Thank you, Farai.
That was our regular tech contributor, Mario Armstrong, and he was at the WYPR studios in Baltimore. 1 week and counting, that's until the Sex and the City movie hits screens nationwide. The TV show about four chic New York friends and their misadventures in love got millions of people watching and talking. But some people literally did not see themselves on the screen, including many black women. So that's where the funkybrownchick.com comes in. It's a site that critics say accurately portrays what it's really like to be black, sexy, and single in the big city. The site won the 2007 Black Weblog Award for Best Humor. And the website creator, blogger, and writer Tawana Hines joins us today to talk about the site. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. So when did you create your blog? Why? And you know, what do you get out of it?
Yeah, sure. I can answer all of those things. I started that particular blog, funkybrownchick.com, in June of 2005. But I've been a writer since I was a child. I wrote for my high school newspaper, and I did a lot of other publications, freelance and things like that. I started that blog. I just moved to New York a few months prior to that. And dating here was a little bit more difficult than dating back home in Chicago. And so I started writing about my dating life and my adventures and misadventures. And one thing led to another, and here I'm talking about it with everybody for News and Notes as well.
Does it ever worry you that you talk about yourself? You know, there's all these concerns about cyber stalking and personal security. What kinds of limits do you put on what you're willing to say?
Definitely. I never share any very specific details about myself. As far as like my name, that's there. What I do throughout my day-to-day activities, that's there. Two things that are completely off topic and I will not speak about on my blog or any of my writing, my job, what I do for my day job, as well as my family. It's not their fault that I have a blog and that I'm writing about my sex life and my dating life, and so I leave them out of that.
Give me an example of something that you've recently written about.
I wrote about going on a date with a high school teacher, actually, and it was a question of whether or not it's okay to split the first bill. You go out for dinner.
Exactly. A classic question for career-minded sisters.
I know. Career-minded sisters, we make our own money and stuff like that. However, is it really reasonable to still expect a guy to pay for the first date, yes or no? And so we had a little conversation about that in the comment section of my blog, and so that was a lot of fun.
What kind of comments do you find yourself getting? I mean, first of all, you know, how do people relate to what you're doing? And do you guys ever get into flame wars or fights about these issues?
I get all kinds of comments. Comments from guys telling me, hey, you know, my boy lives in New York and you should go out with him. I think it's going to be great. So I get those. And then I also get, unfortunately, some nasty comments too. And if it's too nasty, I just delete them right from the blog because there's enough of that stuff out there in the world and I'm not going to bring it home, so to speak, by sticking it on my blog too. And then all kinds of different things. A lot of discussions with people that have specific questions about dating, either in their own hometown or they live here in New York too. And they just want to basically know that they're normal. Like, everyone goes through crazy things in the dating world. And so it's a space where people can go and talk about it.
Given that the Sex and the City movie is coming out and you had Carrie Bradshaw and her friends living in, you know, with the exception of a few passing characters in a mainly white New York, which has always been a question of, like, why are there no black people on Friends until the last season? Why are there no black people on Sex and the City? But that said, what is it that you think African-American women and men who come to your site get in terms of a perspective on the urban cosmopolitan dating scene that they might not get from places that are not targeted to a black audience?
Wonderful. I love that question. A couple different things. One, I think that people have a very clear view that there are millions of black people in this country, and there's millions of different ways to be black. I'm one voice among those. And so people who want to come and just get a view, basically, of what it's like to be black and living in New York and dating and just trying to make my way through the whole, like, freelance writing world and things like that, you get an inside view of it. And so that's really what it's there to provide. I also have, like, a resources section for people who want specifics about what are the dating sites that are out there, what are the podcasts that are out there, where are some of the places I can go to get more information about dating, just in general as well.
What about dating sites? I mean, in the past, you know, like a decade ago, there was just like one or two or three, and now there's bazillions,
exactly.
Sometimes farmed out by one company that creates, you know, the people who do J-Date do a Christian dating site and a black dating site, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, are these sites still as hot as they used to be?
They're still extremely hot. It's a huge industry. There's over 900 different types of dating sites, and the revenue pumped into the economy and the money that they get from making these sites is about $500 million. So that's half a billion dollar industry, specifically for dating sites. One of the trends that you'll see now is everyone knows, of course, like Black People Meet, Match.com, and then some of the more saucy ones like Adult Friend Finder. But those sites are starting to kind of segment and get more specific. Like if you like fishing, or if you want to find other people to go to First Friday's events or something like that, you'll find specific dating sites for that. So you can actually put in whatever your specific interest is, plus dating site, and you can get a very segmented dating site for you.
All right, give me, we just have time for one tip for online dating, something you should do or shouldn't do.
One thing you should do is be yourself. Never, ever, ever post any picture that's like 5 years old and 50 pounds lighter or heavier than you are. It's like your picture should reflect who you are, and the way that you write your profile should reflect who you are as a person, as well as a person that you're trying to attract for a date. Things you should not do: never have someone meet you in your home on a first date that you've never met before. Don't give out any specifics. I say don't tell someone where you work unless you want them to come and visit you there.
Right.
Don't give them your address unless you want them to come and visit you there as well.
All right. Great advice. Thanks, Tawana.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Tawana Hines blogs at funkybrownchick.com, and she joined us from our NPR studios in New York. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits. Devin Robbins and Kenya Young are our directors. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell and Sean Corey Campbell are our drive engineers. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Ernest Champel, Roy Hurst, Drew Tewksbury, Jeff Gardner, and Anthea Raymond. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. On Monday, our Memorial Day show brings stories of courage, forgiveness, and loss. We'll explore the lives of African American servicemen and women.